Well, do you ever feel like life mostly consists of eating, working, and sleeping? It's kind of like those three things take up most of your life. And it just feels like one foot after another. You're just kind of plodding along in life. You get up and you do your habits. You go to work, you eat, you sleep, and then you kind of just go to bed, and then you get up and do the next thing the next day. And it just feels like you've got a routine. You know, you're figuring out how to get the bills paid. You're figuring out how to get by. You're figuring out how to kind of make things work. But it doesn't ever feel like anything changes very much. It feels like you're just kind of plodding along or stumbling along through life. And do you ever stop in the midst of that and have these thoughts where you ask this question in your mind, I wonder if there's something more for my life? Like, I wonder if there's something more out there for me. I wonder if there's I know you have this thought. I wonder if there should be a different job out there for me that would fit me better. I wonder if there's something different in my job that would just be more fulfilling. Or I wonder if there's something about my friendships. I mean, I like my friends, they're good people, but it just feels like it's kind of the same all the time. I wonder if something should change there. Or my habits. I mean, we all have those thoughts. My habits aren't terrible, but I know I could have some better habits, and I wish I had better habits, but I just don't know how to make that change. I don't really have the motivation, and I'm just not sure what to do. Or maybe there's some great accomplishment out there that I should be a part of. Maybe there's something that I should do that would like change the world. You know, we talk about that all the time, and I want that, and I hope for that, and I kind of, in those little moments, every now and then, I daydream about that. But then it's back to the rat race. And then it's back to work and back to plodding along and back to kind of doing all the same things that I always do. And I just don't have those moments very often. Or maybe you don't have those moments at all. But let me ask you this question this morning. What do you want your life to look like 1 year from now? What would you like your life to look like 5 years from now? What would you like your life to look like 10 years from now? Do you want it to look exactly the same as it looks now? And again, it's not that your life is bad now. Or would you love to get 1 year down the road, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, or maybe even to the end of your life and be able to look back and say, wow, my life counted, it mattered, I did something important, I did something significant. It wasn't just the same all the time, but something new happened in my life. In other words, do you envision anything different in your life a year down the road, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road? Because that's what vision is. Vision is simply this, and we're going to put a definition up on the screen, but vision is having a clear picture of the future. Having a clear picture of the future. It's being able to imagine a future that looks different than the present. It's being able to imagine your life being a little bit different than it is today, a year from now, 5 years from now, or 10 years from now. It's being able to imagine a new reality and then letting that new future and that new reality guide your present today. Because if you had a vision for your life that was different, something that you saw, something that you believed would be different a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, it would change the way you live your life now. Here, let me tell you what vision does. If you've got a vision, especially if it's a vision from God, like a God-given vision, here's what vision does for us, and here's what vision gives us. For starters, it gives us purpose. It means our life matters. I mean, if you've got a vision for where you're going and what you're going to do and what it's going to be about, and it's different in the future than it is today, then suddenly it's like your life matters. There's a purpose behind it. There's goals to accomplish. There's things to do. And then you get to the end of a year from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now or even to the end of your life, and you can look back and say, well, I arrived at where God wanted me to arrive. And we all arrive somewhere, right? We're all going to arrive at some destination. But don't you want to get to a destination and say, this is the destination I set out to arrive at? And maybe I got there differently than I thought I was going to get there, and there were tons of ups and downs and tons of surprises along the way. And yet, I felt like there was a vision, and I moved for it. And the last year, the last decade, the last season of my life, my 20s, my 30s, my 40s, my 50s, my teenager years, whatever it is, mattered. Like, they counted. That's what vision does. Vision gives you purpose. Here's what else vision does. Vision gives you direction. You see, if you know where you're going, then it's easy to say yes to the things that are going to help you get there and say no to the things that aren't going to help you get there. I mean, I love to hike, as you could tell by the pictures before, and it's easy when you think about it. I mean, if I have a vision that I'm going to stand on top of that mountain, if that's the goal, if that's where I'm going to be, and I come to a fork in the trail, it's pretty clear to me if one side goes up and the other side goes down away, I need to take the one that's going to help me accomplish the vision that I have. So vision gives you direction. It helps you say yes to the right things and no to the wrong things. Here's what else vision does. Vision gives you passion, even in the mundane things of life, because there's still mundane things of life. There's still routines. There's still habits. There's still paying the bills. There's still getting up and doing that. But all of a sudden, you have a newfound passion because every little piece of your life, even the little details, even your broken past fits into the vision of your future. It's like walking up to a construction site and you see guys sitting there doing work and you ask one of the guys, they're breaking up stones. And you ask one of the guys, what are you doing? And one guy just says, well, I'm just breaking up stones. And you ask a second guy and he says, well, I'm making a living to pay the bills. And you ask a third guy, what are you doing? And he says, I'm building a cathedral. You see, the third guy had vision. Like, he understood that what he was doing fit into a larger purpose, a larger plan, a larger goal, and it was majestic, and it was great, and it was glorious. Even though the mundane things of his life were still there, he understood how they fit, and it gave him passion. He could break up those stones with a passion because he knew the larger framework that they fit into. That's what vision will do. It'll give you passion. But there's one more thing vision will do. It'll give you confidence. You see, when I feel like I'm pursuing a vision that God has given me, like God of the universe, the creator of the universe, has given me a vision, and he's prepared me to do it. Just me, nobody else. He picked only me, and he prepared only me, and he's gifted only me, and he's wired only me. And he only wants me to do it. He wants me to bring all of me. He doesn't want someone else. He doesn't want me to try to imitate someone else's gifts or someone else's passion to do this. He wants me to be a part of it. When I believe that, that gives me so much more confidence to move forward, to trust him, to take risks, because he's called me to, he gave me this vision, and to trust that in his grace and his power, we're going to do amazing things together to accomplish this vision that he's given me. Now, I could say more and more and more about vision, and I could get all Tony Robbins, and we could get all pumped up today and excited about we need vision in our lives, and we need to talk about this, but here's the deal. Here's why for the next 10 weeks we're going to focus on this idea of vision. First, because I think it would be a shame for every single one of us to come back a year from now and feel like nothing in our lives really changed. We just kind of kept plodding along, doing the same thing, and that was it. I mean, I just feel like we should be able to come back a year from now or 2 years from now, if we could, and share together, here's the visions God gave us, and here's what he called us to do. And then we all jumped in, and we got excited, and we were part of it, and it fell apart at this point, and there were challenges along the way, and this happened, and all these things happened. But we were doing something that was significant and mattered. I think God's calling us to do that. Here's the other reason we're going to talk about vision for 10 weeks. Because the Bible actually says that God has prepared things for you to do. It says that he actually has works, he has plans, he has things that fit into his kingdom purposes that he has planned for you specifically to do. He's gifted you, he's wired you, he's educated you, or he didn't educate you. He put you in the family, he gave you the amount of money you've got, he's given you everything you need, and he has prepared you specifically to do something amazing and important and significant for his kingdom. If only our eyes are open and we can see the visions that he wants to give us. And so for the next 10 weeks, we're going to talk about that. Now, there's a story that we're going to look at specifically where this is so clear in the Bible. It's a story of a guy named Nehemiah. And we're going to read his story for the next 10 weeks. We're going to read the whole book. It's this book out of the Old Testament. So if you're not a Bible reader, or especially the Old Testament, those parts get hard. This is going to be fun because we're actually going to read this and unpack it together. And it's one of the exciting, captivating, compelling stories in the Old Testament. And we're going to see how God births a vision in Nehemiah And then it's not just him seeing the vision. Then he goes out and he lives out this vision. And there's all kinds of ups and downs and challenges. And we're going to read about all those and talk about all those and think about all those. And we're going to ask the question all along the way, God, is it possible that you still give huge visions like that? And you've got visions you want to give to each one of us. And then you want to give us the grace and power and strength to go out and pursue them with all we've got. So if you want to read along with me, turn in your Bibles. There's also black Bibles in the seats behind you. You can turn to page 333. That's where it is. Or find the book of Nehemiah. Look it up in the table of contents. It's in the Old Testament. It's before Psalms. So if you go to Psalms, just go backwards. And find Nehemiah chapter 1. And then we'll read through it together in a little bit. But let me set up the context. And some of you love context, and some of you are going, oh, let's just get on with the thing. Like, let's not talk about history. Well, we're going to talk about history for just a little bit. But this is so important, I promise, because this history fits into the story of Nehemiah. And you're going to see it's going to fit into your story and my story as well. So here's the deal. The Old Testament is mostly the story of the people of Israel. And I want to give you a really rough timeline of Israel's history. And when I say rough, I mean rough. About 1250 BC is when the Exodus took place from Egypt. There's debates about exactly when that took place. And we won't get into all the dates and stuff, but just trust me on this one. About 1250 BC is when they left Egypt and, you know, Ten Commandments, entered the Promised Land, all those kind of things. About 1000 BC, and we're more certain about this, there's all kinds of archaeological evidence that corroborates this. About 1000 BC is when they really became a kingdom. They had a king who was sitting on the throne. He built a royal palace. They made Jerusalem the capital city of the kingdom. They built this great temple there where they could worship God. They installed this government with this administration and taxes and all those kind of things that like real kingdoms have. So they became a real kingdom in about 1000 BC, but then things went downhill from there. And shortly after that took place, there was a civil war that led to a split between the people, and they went into two different nations, the northern kingdom of Israel, they kept the name Israel, and the southern kingdom of Judah. And these two nations were led by and large by kings who led the people astray. There were some good kings every now and then, but for decades and centuries, there was king after king after king that were horrible leaders. And they did everything wrong that God asked them not to do. They started worshiping other gods, even though God said, no, just worship me. They started oppressing the poor. The wealthy got more rich, and the poor were oppressed. And they didn't take care of the widows. They didn't take care of the immigrants who had traveled to their country to try to find help or try to find people. They started instituting these prostitution practices that got mixed up with religion. Now, on the whole, they still went to church. Like, they still showed up at the temple. They still offered sacrifices. They sang the songs. They put the words on the screen. You know, all those kind of things. They mouthed all the words. On the surface, everything looked good. They still paid lip service to God, and they called themselves righteous, and they were religious people. But they mixed in all this other terrible stuff. And they were very pluralistic. They set up all these other shrines and all these altars to all these other gods. And it just went on year after year, decade after decade, century after century. Until finally God said, I'm not going to put up with it any longer. I mean, God was patient for hundreds of years with these people. And so in 722 BC, and we know this, this is history, the Assyrians swept in and they destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel because God let them. Because God said, you know what? I'm not going to hold back anymore. I'm going to let you guys reap the consequences of what you're doing. And so the Assyrians came into the northern kingdom of Israel. They destroyed all the fortified towns. They burned them down. They killed a lot of people. They left a bunch of homeless refugees, and then they took a bunch of people and they hauled them off into exile into Assyria. And look at how this is described in the Bible, why this happened. I'm going to read a long passage real quick. This is from the book of 2 Kings, and it comes from the Message translation. This is how it's described, why this exile happened. The exile came about because of sin. The children of Israel sinned against God, their God who had delivered them from Egypt and the brutal oppression of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They took up with other gods. They fell in with the ways of life of the pagan nations God had chased off. And they went along with whatever their kings did. They did all kinds of things on the sly, things offensive to their God, then openly and shamelessly built local sects and religion shrines at every available site. They set up their sects and religion symbols at practically every crossroads. Everywhere you looked, there was smoke from their pagan offerings to the deities, the identical offerings that had gotten the pagan nations off into exile. They had accumulated a long list of evil actions, and God was fed up. He was fed up with their persistent worship of gods carved out of dead wood or shaped out of clay, even though God had plainly said, don't do this, ever. God had taken a stand against Israel and Judah, speaking clearly through countless holy prophets and seers time and time again. So God would send all these prophets and they would say, turn away from your evil life. Do what I tell you and have been telling you in the revelation I gave your ancestors and of which I've kept reminding you ever since through my servants, the prophets. But they wouldn't listen. If anything, they were even more bullheaded than their stubborn ancestors, if that's possible. They were contemptuous of his instructions, the solemn and holy covenant he had made with their ancestors, and of his repeated reminders and warnings. They lived a nothing life, and they became nothings, just like the pagan peoples all around them. And they were well warned. God had said, don't, but they did it anyway. In short, they prostituted themselves to every kind of evil available to them, and God had had enough. So the Assyrians came in and they purged the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, Judah in the south was just as bad. There were a few good kings mixed into Judah, but they were still largely bad, and they did all of the same things. And so not long later, the Babylonians had taken over the Assyrians. God let the Babylonians come in and destroy the southern kingdom of Judah. And it's like God was saying to these people, look, I'm going to remove my hand of protection from you. I have protected you from these Assyrians and these Babylonians and all these other great empires. I've protected you for so long. And yet you keep telling me you don't want to have anything to do with me. You don't want my presence. You don't want my protection. You don't want my provision. You think you can live life better on your own and with your own gods and with your own money and with all your own military alliances and all your power. You think you can do it better on your own. And God says, okay, I'll let you. I'll remove my hand of protection from you. And sure enough, in 586 BC, the Babylonians swept in, and all the gold and all the chariots and all the military alliances that Judah had schemed and all the other gods that they prayed to didn't save them. Babylonian armies surrounded Jerusalem. They tore down the walls. They killed most of the people inside. They tore down the huge temple that Solomon had built that had stood there for hundreds of years. They laid fire, they set the whole city to fire, and it became rubble. Most of the people were killed. Few homeless refugees were left to try to eke out a living in the hillside among the rubble. And then they took all the most important people captive as exiles back to Babylon. And at that point, it seemed like the Israelite people was just a blip on the radar of history. It was just like they had their day, they had come and gone, just like all great empires do. They'd been around for a few hundred years, and then they were gone, and they would never be back. But then something changed. And I know it's a lot of history. Hang with me. We're almost done. 539 BC, a guy named Cyrus the Great, who's the king of Persia, overtakes the Babylonians. And now the Persian kingdom becomes the greatest kingdom in the world. And maybe you remember in school the battles between the Persians and the Greeks, the Battle of Marathon, you know, the guy runs a marathon back to give the news. Like, that's what's happening at this time of history. And the Persians take over the whole world. And Cyrus is different. Cyrus understands if you want to have peace in your kingdom, you should probably let all the local people worship their own local gods. And so he tells the Jews who have been exiled in Babylon, which is now Persia, he says, you know, I'm going to let you go back and rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild your temple, and worship your local God that you call Yahweh. I'll let you worship him because if all the local cultures thrive, then we can probably have better peace in our kingdom. So a few Jews who have been in Persia now for about 40, 50 years, drifted back to Jerusalem, and they started to rebuild. And it took a lot of time. And they tried building the temple first, and it took forever. And even when they got done, it wasn't very nice. It was kind of like, compared to the old temple, it wasn't very nice. It was smaller. It wasn't as glorious. It wasn't as pretty. And that was about it. And for decades, Jews kind of streamed back, and they tried to rebuild the city, and they tried to make life work there. But nothing really happened. Until we come to 445 BC, which is about 100 years later. And there's a guy named Nehemiah. And he lives in Persia. And he's Persian through and through. I mean, he's got a Jewish name, just like I've got a German name. But my ancestors came over from Germany 150 years ago, and there's like no German in me. And so Nehemiah, his dad, his family's lived in Persia. His dad lived in Persia. His grandfather lived in Persia. He is as thoroughly Persian as they are. And he's living there. And it's December. We know this specifically. It's December. He's getting out the Christmas decorations. In 445 BC. And then something happens. Something happens that would change Nehemiah's life. And it would end up changing thousands of other people's lives as well. So let's read, starting in verse 1 of the book of Nehemiah, which is basically his memoirs. So he's telling his story. It says this, "The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, in the month of Kislev," which again corresponds to the end of November, the beginning of December, "in the 20th year," and we know from other writings, he meant the 20th year of the reign of Persian king Artaxerxes I. So that's why we know this is 440. We know exactly when this is, 445 BC. He says, "While I was in the citadel of Susa," Susa was one of the capitals of the Persian kingdom, "Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived and also about Jerusalem." So stop there for a second. He's living in Susa. He has this brother who apparently has traveled down to Jerusalem or maybe lived there for a little while, and he's come back with some other friends. Nehemiah's never been there. He doesn't even know what it looks like, and so he's got this kind of curiosity, and he asks the burning question, like, what's it like? Like, what's it like down there? What's going on? How does the city look? How are people getting along? And look at the response. Verse 3. "They said to me, 'Those who survived the exiles are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire.'" In other words, things aren't great. People aren't doing too well. In fact, if we're brutally honest, it's like a disgrace. I mean, it's just, The city's still in shambles. I mean, even the walls aren't rebuilt yet. The gates aren't rebuilt yet. And you got to remember back then, like, walls and gates is what made a city a city. I mean, in those days when armies and empires swept through and cities changed hands all the time, if you didn't have walls around your city to protect you and then gates so commerce could come in and out, it wasn't really a city. And so he says, look, yeah, they're trying to make things work, but I mean, they don't even have the wall. I mean, it's been 150 years since the Babylonians tore down the walls and burned down the city, and they still haven't even rebuilt the walls. Or if they did, like, it didn't work because they all fell back down, and it's just in rubbles, and it's a disgrace. Now, Jerusalem, if you can imagine, in essence, what they're saying is Jerusalem is like one of these ghost towns you see in the mountains of Colorado. Like, you drive by and you see the old mines, and you can see where the mine shafts were, and you see the old buildings, but they're all, I mean, they're 100 years old and they're about to fall apart and they're all rusted. And it's just like a tourist destination now. Maybe there's like one building that's being rebuilt so you can kind of go look at it and see what it looks like. But you just walk by and you see the glory that it used to have. You see what it used to be this center of commerce. And, I mean, it used to be this hub, this thing where, this place where things were happening, but it's clear. That day is long gone. This is history. It's gone. Nothing is there anymore. That's how Jerusalem looked. That's the report that Nehemiah is hearing. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. And look at how Nehemiah responds. When I heard these things, I sat down and I wept. And for some days I mourned and fasted, and I prayed before the God of heaven. And then we're going to read his prayer. I'm just going to read the rest of the chapter, and then we'll kind of wrap things up. This is what he says. Then I said, Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant, he's talking about himself, is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, and he's quoting from Deuteronomy from hundreds of years before, if you are faithful, this is God speaking to the people back then, if you are faithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and you obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants, Nehemiah continues, and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this, your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. And then look at how he finishes. Give your servant, that's me, give me, Nehemiah, success today by granting me favor in the presence of this man. To which we're going, what man are you talking about? And then he tells us, I was cupbearer to the king. That's an important detail. Nehemiah is living in the capital of Persia. Because he works for the king. He's a cupbearer. That's like the right-hand man of Artaxerxes I, the greatest ruler in the world at the time. Now, we're going to pick up there next week and see why he's asking for success. Because he's about to say something, or he's about to do something, or something's about to happen between him and the king, and it's something really big. And that's where we're going to pick up the story next week. But there's a whole lot going on in this prayer that I don't want to skip over that's so, so important. Because you might be asking at this point in the message, like, what does all of this have to do with me? Like, all of this history and armies and exile and this, yeah, the prayer sounds nice, but what does that have to do with me? Well, I think it has everything to do with you. And here's why. Notice three things real quick about his prayer. First, Nehemiah knew what God was up to in history. He shows that he knew what God was up to in history. He knew that hundreds of years ago, God had set Israel and Jerusalem up to be a light to the nations. And God had linked his name and his character and his reputation to Israel's. So God had said, Israel's reputation is going to be linked to me. And as long as you obey me and as long as you follow me, you will be a light to all the world. And people will look at you and say, those people are amazing. Their God must be amazing. But if you turn your back on me, then I'll scatter you. Because I don't want my name and my reputation and my character linked to you if you're going to go off and do all of these other things and worship other gods, and you're going to be an embarrassment and a disgrace. But Nehemiah also knew that God had said, but even after I scatter you, if you'll turn back to me and you'll repent, then I will bring you back and I'll link up with you again and I will put my name and my reputation on the line with you as a nation and as a people. And Nehemiah knew that God was in the process of doing that. I mean, it had been 100 years, but people had started trickling back. They had started rebuilding the city, and they were trying to do what God had called them to do. Nehemiah understood what God was up to in history, which leads to a second important point. Nehemiah was concerned with the things that God was concerned with. So that when he heard what he knew what God was up to in history, and he knew the people were moving back to be a part of what God was up to in history. But when he heard the news that the city was still a disgrace and the walls were still in rubble, it broke Nehemiah's heart. He says he sat down and he wept. And then he fasted. He lost his appetite. It's like he got to the point where he was so overcome with grief. And in the Bible, that's what fasting usually is about. It's people overcome with grief so much that fasting is just a physical manifestation of what's going on in their soul. It's them saying, I just don't even want to eat anymore because right now, all I hunger for is God and his grace in this terrible moment. And so it says he sat down and he wept and he fasted. Now, stop there for a second. When's the last time you wept and fasted for something other than yourself? I mean, we all weep about things in our own lives. And maybe you get to a point where something's so terrible in your life, you'll even lose your appetite or you're fast about it because you're crying out to God, save me. But when's the last time you wept? When's the last time I wept and we fasted over something going on somewhere else in someone else's life? But that was Nehemiah. So he gets this news, and he's sitting there in Persia. And the easy thing for him would be like, oh, the walls are down? Oh, that's a bummer. Like, oh, that is tragic. Like, I will pray for that. I'm going to email people and tell them to pray. And you know what? Let me write a check, $50. I want to help with the walls. And I'm gonna start an awareness campaign. You know what? We're going to get some awareness about this issue out there. And I want to do my part to help. Nehemiah could have done that. But it says he wept and he prayed and he fasted and then he confessed his sin. Like he's making himself the same as the people hundreds of years ago. He's saying all the sin and rebellion and rejection and selfishness that they did and they had. I'm going to be honest, God, it's in here too. Like, I've got it. I do that in my own ways, in my own life. I am just as complicit in rebelling against you as all the people hundreds of years ago. I could stand under judgment just as much as they could. And so I'm just going to come to you, and I'm confessing, and I'm weeping, and I'm repenting. I'm throwing myself on you. It's like it broke Nehemiah's heart. And then here's the third thing, the most important thing. As Nehemiah knew what God was up to in history, and as Nehemiah was concerned with the things that God was concerned with, as Nehemiah wrestled with the tension of what is Jerusalem, walls in shame, crumbling, in shambles, in ruins, nothing's happening, and then what could be and what should be, God making Jerusalem a light to all the nations, and the tension of wrestling with what is and what could be, a vision was born in Nehemiah. Now, we're going to come back and read about what that vision is next week. But in the midst of that, as he wrestled with that and as he struggled with that, it's like God said, yes, there is this huge gap between what is and what could be and what should be. And Nehemiah, I want you to jump in. I'm going to give you a vision to be a part of something big happening so that it will no longer be what is in a year. It'll be what could be. And what should be. Now, the reason that has everything to do with you and with me is because we also know what God is up to in history right now. We know what God is up to in history. I'll give you just a quick definition of what God is up to in history. God's about bringing his rule and his reign, his redemption and his restoration into every part of this world. To every nook and cranny of this world, he's about bringing his rule and his reign, his redemption and his restoration. And it starts with people and their lives. It starts with God doing it in people's lives. Here's what he's not up to in history. He's not up to making people rich, even though he does that sometimes. He's not into making sure we all have great jobs, even though he does that sometimes. He's not into making sure we all get married when we want to, and we have the families we want to, and our kids grow up to be the kids we want to. Even though sometimes he does it. He's not into healing every disease or illness we have. He doesn't answer that prayer every time, even though sometimes he does answer that prayer. But there is one prayer he answers every single time. There's one prayer he answers every single time somebody prays it. It's simple. It's when somebody comes to him and says, I'm messed up. I'm broken. I'm selfish and I'm sinful. And I just want to turn to you, God. And I want you to rule and reign in my life. And I want you to redeem and restore me. every single time someone comes to him and says, I want to turn away from that life. I want to turn away from not trusting you in this area of my life. I want to give it over to you, and I'm turning to you. That's what God is about in history. That's the prayer God answers. There's more, Jesus said it this way, there's more partying in heaven. There's more joy in heaven. There's more rejoicing in heaven when one person is in the process of turning their life over to Jesus and to his lordship and to his rule and to his reign than over 99 people who are just kind of doing their own thing, not really caring about what's going on. That's what God is up to in history. People turning their lives over to him. So here's the question I want to end with. Am I concerned with the things that concern God? Am I concerned with that? I mean, do I look at people in this world? Do I look at my own life? Do I look at everyone around me? And am I broken by the things that God is broken by? When I see places in this world where God's rule and reign isn't happening, where God's redemption and restoration isn't, when I see friends, when I see coworkers, when I see people that I know who haven't really given their lives to Jesus and they haven't experienced his redemption and restoration, does it break my heart? Does it make me weep and fast and pray on my knees day in and day out? When we see schools and kids who don't have mentors, who don't have people who can give them examples of how to untangle the mess in their lives and find redemption and restoration, does that break our hearts? We see people around the world who've never even heard of Jesus. Does that break our hearts? Because if it does, and when it does, in that tension, if we wrestle in the same way Nehemiah wrestled with what is and then what could be and what should be, God will birth vision in our lives. So here's the only takeaway for today. What if we all decided we were just going to pray? And we don't even have to pray for vision. All we have to do is pray, God, help us to be concerned with the things you're concerned with. Help me to see people. Help me to see my neighbors the way you see them. Help me to see people in school, people at my job, my boss. Help me see illegal immigrants the way you see them. Not the way the government sees them, not the way political parties see them. Help me see them the way you see them. Help me see the poor the way you see them. Help me see people in other places in the world who've never heard you. Help me to see them the way you see them. What if we all just prayed that? And then we waited to see the tension that built up as we saw what is and what could be and what should be. I think if we all did that, I hope, I pray, over the next 10 weeks, God will birth some amazing visions in our lives. So we can come back here a year from now and say, we were a part of something amazing God was doing in history right now. Let me pray. God, as we close today, even as we sing one more song, as we sing the words, God, I pray that the words would be like a prayer. God, I remember the story of when you came into Jerusalem. It was still a bustling city that last week of your life. You came in and people shouted, Hosanna, which means God save us. And they believed that you were like the king coming to save them. God, we still believe that today, that you are the king of this world. And that you want to bring your rule and your reign and your redemption and your restoration into every part of it. And so we pray that you would open our eyes. And the way Jesus healed people who didn't have vision, we pray that you would give us vision as well. Pray this in your name. Amen.